It's Wednesday, July 31st. I'm Tanzina Vega. On today's Takeaway, more Puerto Ricans live off the island than on it, and the people in the diaspora experience the recent political upheaval in their own way.
You know, we had so many spontaneous protests occur and celebrations occur throughout New York that while we were not in Puerto Rico, we felt the reverberations of that energy.
It was basically like Puerto Rico came out, but it came out in support of the LGBTQ people. It was like reverse coming out of the closet.
This resilience spreads beyond just the Puerto Rican people. I think, you know, all humanitarians can feel like, okay, this is happening and this is our time to rise up and not back down.
Also on the show, we put last night's Democratic debate in context, and a recent copyright infringement decision involving Katy Perry and a Christian rap group highlights the squishiness of the law.
There is no okay with copying. The law only has this rather unhelpful adjective, substantial.
All right, let's get to it. By the end of this week, Puerto Rico's governor, Ricardo Rosselló, is expected to vacate his office, leaving behind a fractured government. Rosselló announced on Twitter that he selected a new Secretary of State, Pedro Pierluisi, who's expected to replace him. But as we've reported on The Takeaway, political unrest of the past few years, including the fallout from Hurricane Maria, the economic crisis on the island, and the ensuing displacement of thousands of Puerto Ricans, have brought the diaspora closer together than perhaps any other time in history. And now millions of Puerto Ricans on the island, in the continental U.S. and around the world, are poised to decide what to do with that political power and where they go from here. And we wanted to hear from three Puerto Ricans here in New York City. Caridad de la Luz, otherwise known as La Bruja, is a poet, musician, and activist. Andrew Padilla is an artist, educator, and journalist. And Sammy Nevir Olivares is an LGBTQ activist. Thank you all for joining me.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you.
It's great to be here.
I think it's time that we have a conversation about what I'm saying is this sort of next level for the Puerto Rican conversation in the United States, which is really examining where we go from here after we've saw Hurricane Maria, after the protest, after Rosselló stepped down, and examining a lot of this idea of the diaspora. Who are we and what does that mean today? And so we're going to unpack a lot of these issues. The big news was Governor Rosselló announced that he was stepping down. This was historic. This was unprecedented. This has never happened. When you each heard the news, how did you feel, Andrew?
I heard the news that Rosselló was maybe going to resign. Reports were he was going to resign at 9, at 10, at 11, at 12, at 5, at 6. So how did I feel? I felt exhausted. I felt exhausted by the time we finally knew that he was going to step down on now this Friday. So I felt exhausted, but I also felt relieved and feel like we were heard for the first time in a very long while.
Caridad, what about you?
I found the news absolutely exhilarating. And I don't trust the government, so I was then quickly thinking, okay, so then what's the plan, really? What's really going to happen? What does this mean? Because at first, I really didn't think it was going to happen. But the resilience of our people, you know, we're not backing down. And, you know, our people have taken so much. We've lost families. I mean, my grandmother is displaced. My abuelita living in Manatí all her life, you know, my childhood respite was destroyed by Hurricane Maria, and she's in Texas now, and I'm thinking, okay, so how are we really going to repair this? How are we going to get back on our feet? So, like, all these questions, like, it was exhilarating, and then it was quick, like, back to business. Okay, what's the plan? What's going to happen?
Sammy, what about you? What was your reaction when you heard Rosselló step down?
Well, I share the relieved part because it was a long day and actually 12 days of emotional trauma, and the administration was doing it on purpose to drain people out and to suppress the insurgency. I also was exhilarated, but mostly pride. I was very proud of the people of Puerto Rico who came together to the streets. And while we have done it before to remove the Navy out of Vieques, and while the university students from University of Puerto Rico, where I was studying, did that for 6 months. It had never taken a mass mobilization of 500,000 people. So, and consistently. And most importantly, against our own government. And in Puerto Rico, when you go against one of the two main parties, you're basically blacklisted, right? So to see that resiliency, but like defiance and determination was very impressive and very emotional. It was very frustrating, but also emotional for us in the diaspora that we could not be there, but also that we were in spirit.
So let's talk a little bit about, I mean, because this idea that what we saw, I think, in the protests was, as you mentioned, Sammy, there were, the diaspora was watching, but the diaspora was also participating mm-hmm. in the yes. protests, right? Which to me was something unprecedented as well, that we saw protests in New York, we saw protests around the world. Andrew, you were tweeting a lot about this and about the images that you saw. What struck you about that?
What struck me was that you had so many people in the diaspora coming out to protest that you don't normally see protests. So we had folks come out to Union Square and Columbus Circle and Grand Central, and that was powerful. Defend PR, NY Boricua Resistance. Like, there was a lot of people that were making that happen. But in those places, you know, you saw the usual faces, but you also saw a lot of new people. And in my neighborhood of East Harlem, Grisel Robles, along with a bunch of her neighbors, came together in Taino Towers to do a spontaneous protest that was largely for folks who either were on the elderly side and weren't going to head down, or a little too young to head down by themselves, or had work and, you know, decided they wanted to celebrate this with their neighbors. And so, you know, we had so many spontaneous protests occur and celebrations occur throughout New York that while we were not in Puerto Rico, we felt the reverberations of that energy. And we were all kind of committed to trying to move that forward from wherever we were.
Caridad, you were at some of the protests as well. Tell us about what you were doing and what the mood was in these protests for you.
It was this energy that was palpable. And I mean, they came with pots and pans. People had whistles. They had flags that were so huge, like on these long poles. And you know, we were at Columbus Circle, right there next to Trump Tower, and it started with a few, and then they just kept coming and coming, and then it was a larger group, and there was cameras everywhere, and then, you know, it was hard to even stand, like, then, you know, like, they had to ask people to move a little bit back just so you could see where is the front line, and then it started to rain. And that was like a blessing. And then it rained over here, rained over there. And, you know, I'm La Bruja, you know, so it's all that stuff means things to me. So it was like a blessing from the skies. It was the tears of our people in heaven. It was to stay resilient, keep going. And then the march, then all the way to Grand Central. And it was, you know, it was just magical. After Hurricane Maria and after Rosselló and after seeing the corruption, and I think those people that didn't think it was possible that to be living under such corruption finally had to accept that it was true. So it's like painful, it's mourning, but at the same time, it's like the fighting spirit is here. So I hope that this resilience spreads beyond just the Puerto Rican people. I think, you know, all humanitarians can feel like, okay, this is happening, and this is our time to rise up and not back down.
And so we're in this moment of diasporic unity, if you will, right? We're here on the island, around the world, and in the continental United States, we're having this moment as Boricuas, as Puerto Ricans. But it hasn't always been that way. There's always, for those of us who grew up in New York, I think there was always a, yes, we go to visit the island every summer, and we go to Manatí or Barceloneta or whatever, and we spend the summer there, but then are you really Puerto Rican? Are you New Yorican? Like, where does that really fall in? And I'm curious to hear your thoughts on that division. Sammy, you grew up there. What was the view of us folks coming to the island before this moment of sort of national unity?
I was born and raised in Puerto Rico, but mentally I identify as a New Yorican because I read this history. I read how Julia de Burgos was created files by the FBI and she had to flee Puerto Rico. And she felt so Puerto Rican in soul and spirit But yet she found herself in New York because she was not considered Puerto Rican in the island and she was not New Yorkian in here. So I read her poetry and I said, I'm going to live there when I'm abroad. And I wanted to be New Yorkian because of that history of helping the island from afar, having achieved freedom and liberty. But always worried me that Julia de Burgos, while we admire her, the rest of the people, like the Puerto Ricans in the Bronx and the Puerto Ricans who are loud and wear the wave the flag in the Puerto Rican parade, were seen, you know, as not as Puerto Ricans because they do not speak Spanish, because they have never been to the island, or because they culturally express differently. But I also believe that the media has a lot to do with that, because Puerto Rican main newspaper, El Nuevo Día, and TV have always treat the diaspora as something, as the other. So it's not as a unity, not as a body. For example, news from the United States are filed under the international section. And we see Trump and the federal government as the United States government. So I think that division happened, but it crashed after Hurricane Maria. Hurricane Maria brought everyone together, and people saw that in light of the vacuum from the federal government and Puerto Rican governor, it was the diaspora who stepped in and went and helped. So, and now half of Puerto Ricans are in the diaspora after Hurricane Maria. So now every single family has one, two, or more in the diaspora. So now it's really difficult for them to see the diaspora as the other. And now we are just enmeshed. And Puerto Rico is actually not in the island, it is outside. We are spread among the world. And so we are a nation spread. So now there is no division between the diaspora and the island.
And I'm curious, Caridad, when you said your grandmother went from Manatí and she was sort of had to leave after Hurricane Maria and she's in Texas. One thing that's interesting to me is to your point also, Sammy, is that we are not only coming to the places where we used to come, which was New York, maybe Chicago, right? We're everywhere now in the United States. And Andrew, I'm wondering what you see as the impact that diaspora here, the spread of the diaspora throughout the United States, outside of the traditional pockets of Puerto Ricans, if you will, the places that we used to only go to, like Texas, like North Carolina, like California, like Arizona, like Philadelphia. I mean, we're literally everywhere. What impact do you see that having, whether it's cultural or otherwise?
Well, one of the things that Maria reminded us is, as was just said, our diaspora is not only across the U.S., it's global. I mean, we after Maria, people in every major, Boricuas in every major U.S. city got together to do something after Maria, right? To raise money, to send supplies, support, raise awareness, do whatever they could. But this also happened across the world. I mean, you had Boricuas in London, in Spain, in the Netherlands, in Slovenia, in Australia, in Switzerland, where at the time I was doing my master's, who were getting together money, right? Were doing events in whatever part of the world they were to support the island. And so a lot of the diaspora engagement you've seen now, you know, that's kind of a lot of the groundwork also that happened after Maria. A lot of these spontaneous protests you see happening are a lot of the same faces that were doing something for the island after Maria.
One of the things that we've talked about, everybody from 1898, we've talked about Julia de Burgos, we've talked about the broader diaspora, but there was a parallel, I don't want to say parallel movement, there was a movement here in the 1960s and 70s in New York called the Young Lords. This was perhaps, for those of us of a certain age, that we remember seeing, you know, that type of activism among Puerto Ricans in New York. I'm wondering, are there any parallels or any historical parallels that we can draw from what the Young Lords activism looked like to what we're seeing today? Or is today just a completely different beast altogether? Whoever wants to take that is fine.
The Young Lords were listening to their people. They were listening to disenfranchised communities of color in New York and asking them what they wanted and trying to act on those needs. And that's the exact opposite of what the Puerto Rican government has done. And that's part of what has really gotten people so upset. You know, all of us growing up right now, we haven't lived in a time where the Puerto Rican government really prioritized the needs of Puerto Ricans first. We don't really know what that would look like.
And a major difference between both is that John Lourdes was like personality driven of real like leaders. And this is absolutely horizontal movement where there is no actual leaders. And I think that's also unprecedented in Puerto Rico. You always have like leaders who organizations who push for it. But this was so spontaneous. Not, I would not say completely organic, but because there were many groups that were organizing about all these issues, but they was just like jumped in. And it was like women were an LGBTQ and young people and students were the ones who jumped in.
You mentioned this movement, Sammy, and women. And one of the things the Young Lords had to reckon with was their own sexism, their own machismo within the party. Caridad, you're nodding because we know that that happened. They had to reckon with this idea of bringing women to the table as equals. And that was a very different conversation in the 1970s. But here we are in 2019. Caridad, as a woman, as an activist, as a Puerto Rican, how has it changed, if in your opinion? Like, does this movement really bring to light the issues that women are facing, not just Puerto Ricans, but Puerto Rican women? And does it put women at the center of the conversation?
Well, in the chat, you know, the way that the women were addressed, and this is a politician, this is a leader of, you know, Puerto Rico, but it's been, you know, the whole puta thing and the, you know, that's basically how women are looked upon by machistas, like the whole misogynistic and toxic masculinity that was how we've grown up. And in the Young Lords, yes, they did have to deal with those issues and unsuccessfully, because what happened then, they couldn't actually accept that women could be equals, and it disbanded and it dissipated, and they just celebrated 50 years since, you know, the Young Lords. And you know, and I myself have experienced toxic masculinity from a Young Lord. This is not a shaft, papa. This is not, you know, this is not jive we're talking. This is life. This is equality. This is important. I am a human being. You're not above me. You know, we treat our women the way we treat our planet. Bottom line, exploit, take, destroy, pillage, all of those things, you know, and we're seeing that today. And, you know, the fact that we have these leaders like Alejandra Ocasio-Cortez, that we have, you know, Melissa Mark Viverito, that we have a Carmen Yulín Cruz, that's amazing. But to know that they are suffering the slings and arrows of this still, you know, it's a fight. It's still part of the fight. It makes me really emotional because it's tiring. It's enough. The fight is big enough, but to still have that underlying current of not being enough or not, you know, is really sad.
Sammy, another issue that's come up in these protests, or not issue, but another interesting part of the protests have been the inclusion of the LGBTQ community. Similar to the question that I just asked Caridad about the role of women, what has been the history, if you will, of LGBTQ Puerto Ricans, their inclusion in any of these movements, and not just their inclusion as individuals, but their inclusion with the issues that affect them as well?
When we talk about LGBTQ people, what people in Puerto Rico are afraid of, transgender people, are about effeminate gay people. So this is about gender issue. And like the same way that women are discriminated against in Puerto Rico and attacked is the same gender violence that is impacting the LGBTQ community. And I think it was beautiful that it was the poetic justice that it was attacks to women and LGBTQ people who took down this machista government and the most important history, a chapter in our history. Because as Caridad said, in that chat, the text messages that most affected people were the ones against women, the ones against LGBTQ people, particularly Ricky Martin at this point, and about the death of Maria, right? So to see 500,000 people coming out in support of that, it was basically like Puerto Rico came out, but it came out in support of the LGBTQ people. It was like reverse coming out of the closet, because coming out of supporting of the LGBTQ movement in Puerto Rico, it is devastating for your career, for you. People, it's not well seen that you support the LGBTQ movement. I was born and raised in the South, and it was very homophobic. I left Puerto Rico because of the sexual repression. I couldn't leave. I couldn't be who I am. So many people who have left the island, it's not only because of the lack of economic opportunities, it is because of gender repression, right? And to see that support and the LGBTQ flag wave in the protest and people supporting Ricky Martin and all LGBTQ was a beautiful thing. And that's what people now in the island has to get used to.
Andrew, where do we go from here? The fight, as many activists have said, is not over, but thinking more broadly, where does the diaspora and where does Puerto Rico go from here?
I think the only way that we maintain Puerto Rico as an island for Puerto Ricans is by us keeping the pressure on. I mean, our island is in an existential crisis. The UN estimates that our population is going to drop from 3 million to 1.2 at the end of this century. And so I don't know what is going to eventually solve Puerto Rico's problems, but I think there is a unity amongst people in Puerto Rico and the diaspora that we have to solve that, right? That is our right. It is our right to determine our own future.
Andrew Padilla is an artist, educator, and journalist, and I've also been speaking with Caridad de la Luz, otherwise known as La Bruja, a poet, musician, and activist, and with Sammy Nemir Olivares, an LGBTQ activist. Thanks to you all for being with us.
Thank you.
And you can find all of our Puerto Rico coverage at thetakeaway.org/Puerto Rico. On Tuesday, the first of this week's two Democratic presidential debates took place in Detroit. And although there are several high-profile candidates of color in this year's field, all of the politicians on stage last night were white. The demographics among those 10 Democrats was a sharp contrast to the population of Detroit, which is 79% black. And if the Democrats want to win in 2020, they'll have to do more than just take black voters for granted. Turnout among black voters nationwide fell 7% from 2012 to 2016. Joining me now to discuss some of the issues that matter most to black voters heading into 2020 is Erin Haynes-Wack, who's focusing on exactly these issues. She's the Associated Press national writer on race and ethnicity. Erin, great to have you back on.
Thanks so much for having me. Good to be with you.
Also with us is Kat Stafford, a reporter at the Detroit Free Press. Kat, thanks for being with us.
Thanks for having me, too.
So, Kat, let's start with you. Were there any moments that stood out to you during last night's debate where you felt like the candidates were speaking directly to black voters in areas like Detroit?
Here's the thing. This is actually one of the first things I noticed. I'm going to kind of flip it for you. I noticed a lack of direct discussion about issues impacting voters in cities like Detroit. It was almost an hour into the debate, and we had yet to hear about poverty, criminal justice reform, lack of jobs. You know, it was just kind of interesting to see a lack of discussion around these issues, considering Michigan, we know, is going to be a battleground state, and Detroit voters will be key for Democrats in 2020.
Erin, as I mentioned, all the candidates at last night's debate were white. How do you think they did when it came to discussing race and racism? What's your take?
Well, you know, to Kat's point, I also thought that it was notable that race did not come up until well into hour two. I think I heard the first mention of Flint somewhere after 9:30. In terms of really talking about issues of race, I think that is something that voters, especially voters of color, are expecting to see from all of the candidates. You have white candidates who are having to reckon with issues of race, with issues, frankly, of white identity, and how they are going to use white privilege to create a platform to make a more equal and perfect union. Marianne Williamson certainly got a lot of applause for her response on reparations. Mayor Pete Buttigieg was asked about how he would be the best candidate to serve African Americans, given his stumbles on race as mayor of South Bend. And, you know, he didn't really get a lot of applause. I think the two kind of front runners in last night's debate, Senator Bernie Sanders and Senator Elizabeth Warren, have both, at least on the campaign trail, talked a lot about the issue of systemic racism and how they would plan to address that if they were elected, I think that race did eventually still make it onto the stage last night.
Erin, you mentioned Marianne Williamson, and she's become sort of the Twitter darling of the night. I want to play a brief portion of her clip. And Kat, I'd love to get your thoughts on that.
We need to say it like it is. It's bigger than Flint. It's all over this country. It's particularly people of color. It's particularly people who do not have the money to fight back. And if the Democrats don't start saying it, then why would those people feel that they're there for us? And if those people don't feel it, they won't vote for us. And Donald Trump will win.
Kat, your assessment on that, because Donald Trump was one of the main characters, if you will, in the debate from the beginning. So your response on Williamson's quote right there.
Well, what's interesting is, you know, I talked to a couple folks who were at various watch parties across the city. There was one focused, you know, solely on Black mothers. And a lot of people were, I would say, pleasantly surprised by her performance last night. And she was directly hitting on, as Erin said, the systemic racism that we've seen across the country. And, you know, a lot of people felt that she was the one that was speaking directly to them, speaking directly to a lot of the issues that they have. And they were happy to see someone directly addressing the, you know, the issue of reparations.
Erin, we know that voter apathy is usually a problem for Democrats. But in 2016, and I think we're looking ahead to 2020, the issue of voter suppression looms large. How will that play out in states like Michigan?
Well, I think it's definitely a concern, right? Democrats are certainly working hard to mobilize and galvanize Black voters in states like Michigan, also Wisconsin and Pennsylvania. But voter suppression, that can take a lot of forms that people maybe don't think about. Those long lines, for example, can turn people away who maybe need to get back to their job or need to go home to pick up a child or a relative. In addition, you know, certainly there is a concern. We just heard from Robert Mueller earlier this month saying that you have foreign agencies that are actively working to interfere in this election again, you know, via social media. And we know that a lot of that interference did target voters of color around issues of race. That can certainly be a factor in states like Michigan, where, you know, Democrats lost by something like 11,000 votes.
Is it also a question, and I'll pose this to either of you, is it also a question of how the media is framing the quote unquote Midwestern vote and who we consider to be that vote, whether indirectly or directly? Is it an assumption that the Midwestern voters are white, middle class voters? And do we often forget about the actual racial diversity in the Midwest and what that vote could look like?
Absolutely, Tanzina. I mean, you would think the Great Migration never happened, right? Who we talk about when we're talking about Midwestern voters or who is in the Rust Belt or the Heartland, or even when we talk about issues of economic anxiety. Economic anxiety is very much on display in Michigan with voters of color, frankly, who are worried about their opportunities in terms of jobs, in terms of housing, in terms of health care. You know, voters of color are issues voters, just like everyone else, but they're not always seen that way, and they're not always treated that way. Black voters, despite the fact that they are the most consistent and loyal bloc of the Democratic Party, I mean, their vote is to be earned, too, and they are to be courted in this election, just like everybody else.
Kat, we reached out to Black Takeaway listeners in Michigan to hear what they're looking for from presidential candidates in 2020. And we heard a lot of the things that you outlined: universal health care, eliminating student debt, bringing the country together, not treating Black voters like a monolith. But one of the things we know is that, at least on when you flip that, politicians have often come to Detroit telling voters that they're going to bring business back to the city and help rebuild it. How do Michiganders and Detroit residents in particular feel about so many years of those promises? Do they feel cynical about the political process, or are they engaged right now from your perspective and you're talking to folks on the ground out there?
Yeah, that's a really sensitive topic, especially for Detroiters, because, you know, the city is in the middle of this quote unquote recovery that, you know, you see this national narrative being pushed about Detroit being on a rebound. It's the comeback city of America. But really, when you just go a couple miles outside of where the debates were held yesterday and where they will be tonight, it's blight. It's poverty. It's a stark difference to what you see downtown. And, you know, one of the things that I noticed last night was when Delaney, you know, he made this comment that referenced, you know, how politicians, you know, government and the business community are working together to, you know, make the city, you know, come back. You know, there was a lot of reaction on social media about that because it felt like there was a just complete disconnect. You know, they felt that, you know, they really weren't tuned in. You come to Michigan, but you don't know the environment because right now there's this huge push and pull of, you know, resources being allocated fairly across the city. And I think, again, what you're seeing here is not just in Detroit. It's in other cities that are similar to the city, you know, like Chicago. So I think that's a huge concern, you know, for voters. They want someone who's really tuned into what's going on in their community.
Kat Stafford is a reporter at the Detroit Free Press, and Aaron Haynes-Wack is a reporter on race and ethnicity for the Associated Press. Thanks to you both for this conversation.
Thank you.
Thanks. Here you are, you're gonna come to me. Here you are, but you
better choose carefully. Do these songs sound similar to you? I've been a Christian quite a few years. Victory and faith, but I failed in my. A jury in Los Angeles thought so, and they decided on Monday that the underlying beat of Katy Perry's 2013 hit Dark Horse infringed on the musical copyright of Joyful Noise by the Christian rap group Flame. But forensic musicology is a lot more complicated than two songs sounding alike. Joe Bennett should know. He's a forensic musicologist from Berklee College of Music in Boston, and he joins us from his home studio. Joe, I understand you've got your guitar at the ready?
Yes, I always have it by my side.
Excellent. Well, welcome to The Takeaway.
Thank you. It's good to be here.
So what's your forensic musicologist take on these two songs, Dark Horse and Joyful Noise?
Well, I think the challenge that these cases always bring is that everyone has an opinion, you know, and so we hear these songs and people think, well, it sounds a bit the same to me. But obviously there's a chasm between the concept of sounds a bit the same to me and the idea of actual copyright plagiarism, that is copying something that was created by someone else and using it in your work. So as to my opinion on this particular case, well, it seems to me that the argument's going to hinge on that 8-note riff that we just heard, which I'll play a little bit of on guitar here. The first thing to say is the songs are in different keys. So Dark Horse is in the key of B flat minor, which is this key. And the riff to Dark Horse goes like this. And the song Joyful Noise is in the key of A minor, and the riff goes like this. So you can see why people might think that they sound similar. But lots of things in popular music sound similar, and one thing that a forensic musicologist would need to do was, first of all, to establish whether they are similar enough, that is to compare the musical facts. And as you just heard there, the songs contain an 8-note riff, and in this particular case, 6 of the 8th notes are identical, by which I mean they use the same or equivalent pitches with the same rhythmic value of the notes, that is where they fall in the musical timing. So the first step in a musicological analysis of a simple riff like this would be to simply line up the melodies and play them back to back and then compare for similarity, just to get to the facts. That's normally what a client wants, first of all.
What's your take on the jury's decision on that?
Well, no one can ever know what goes on in a jury room. So with that caveat, all I have to go on is the music. And so to get to some of the musical facts, those 8-note phrases are not identical to each other. Only 6 notes out of 8 are identical. So you have to ask yourself, how possible is independent creation? That is, two composers independently coming up with the same, in this case, 6-note riff. And because it's such a simple riff, it's on the beat, it starts with 4 repeated notes, and it simply descends the minor scale. My opinion, for what it's worth, as someone who wasn't involved in the case but has analyzed the music, is that this could easily be a case of independent creation. That is, two people coming up with the same thing independently of each other.
Now, Joe, when you're looking, is there a sort of a magic number when you're thinking, okay, there's eight note riffs here. We need to hit all of the eight notes, but they need to be, it's okay if they're in different keys. What's the breaking point beyond just they sound the same for an expert like yourself?
This is very much the question of forensic musicology. What is the similarity threshold? And what I find interesting about this question is that there's a whole mythology culture built up among musicians, some very successful musicians in many cases, who believe that there is a specific number of notes that you can copy legitimately in a melody, or in audio, a specific number of seconds that you can sample from someone else's work. And the disappointing news is that there is no magic number. There is no statute or law anywhere in the world that has that specific musical information in it. And so I spend a lot of time working with my clients trying to say, well, there is no okay with copying. The law only has this rather unhelpful adjective, substantial. So if you copy a substantial part of an earlier work, then that can be considered copyright infringement. But what these cases often hinge on is the arguments back and forth of what constitutes substantial. That said, my reports often do get into numbers because of probability math. That is, the longer a melodic similarity, the more consecutive notes that are identical between any two works, the higher the probability that one is copied from another, just because it's the grain of rice on a chessboard theory, that the math multiplies up very rapidly, what theorists call Markov chains.
Joe, I'd love to, there is an example, an older example of music copyright infringement from 1976, where a judge decided that George Harrison's My Sweet Lord copied He's So Fine by the Chiffons. I'd love if you could give us an example of those two songs there so we can hear maybe why the judge decided the way they did.
Yeah, so My Sweet Lord was one of the most famous cases of the 20th century. It referred to George Harrison's song of that title from 1970 that was alleged to infringe the melody and the chords, because the underlying chords can be very important, of that song by the Chiffons, He's So Fine. I think to start with, let's just hear the originals back to back. So when we hear those songs back to back, the first thing that hits our ears maybe is the production of the song. You know, one is a sort of a big acoustic light rock band, the George Harrison song we heard, and the other is a sort of 60s girl band vibe. And what we try to do is in forensic musicology in the analysis is to push past the production and listen for the core underlying musical composition. So in that particular case, that famous dispute over melody and harmony in My Sweet Lord, we're dealing with these melodic elements. This is the melody of My Sweet Lord, etc., repeating a few times, and then that rise to the chorus, I really want to see you. And in the case of the Chiffon song, it's in a different key, it's in the key of G, and it goes like this. And variations thereof. So the melodies are basically the same. But one of the things that we would do in a musicological analysis that's actually a lot more technically possible now in 2019 than it was in 1976 is that we would re-pitch the audio. And so what I have here is a little bit of analysis of the two, where I have increased the tempo of My Sweet Lord and I've repitched He's So Fine down a third so that it plays in the same key as My Sweet Lord. And I've lined them up. And the thing to listen out for is that I really want to see you when it goes to that pre-chorus or that chorus section, that those occur contextually at the same time and basically go to the same chord. So here they are, left and right, lined up.
Now, I have to say, that's pretty darn close, and I have a music background, but I'm not a musicologist, and I can probably see how the judge, or why the judge, decided like they did on this case in 1976. My question for you is, these cases are usually, if they're in front of a jury, the jury is not full of musical experts, they're not full of musicologists, and so they're just average everyday folks looking for something that sounds similar, right?
Right. And this is a phenomenon that's particularly prevalent and, as far as I know, unique to the US. That is, these trials actually use a jury, and that jury is normally composed, well, by definition, of randomly selected people who may or may not be musicians. Now, in a dispute like this, either side would have, or both sides would have, a musicologist who would explain the musical facts to the jury. And as a musicologist, you're brought in really to only get to the facts, which means I sometimes disappoint my clients by saying, I'm sorry, there is no infringement, even if they think there is. But it is a challenge because, as I said at the start, everyone has an opinion on whether something is similar, but similarity does not necessarily mean copying, and copying does not necessarily mean copyright infringement. And the threshold for each of those things is higher in each case.
Are we at a point, Joe, where this type of lawsuit or these types of cases are going to become more and more prevalent? I'm just thinking, given the expansion and the way that we access music, how easy it is for people to produce their own music, upload their own music. I mean, at what point are these just purely coincidences, or really how much of this is how do you prove intent to copy or infringe at today versus just coincidence?
Yeah, it's a real challenge, isn't it? How do you prove intent? How shall one know the mind of the composer? And of course, it's impossible to see inside anyone's creative mind. So we look for secondary clues, like the extent of a note chain. But in answer to the question of whether these lawsuits are more prevalent now than previously, there's certainly a greater awareness in the ether. At Berklee College of Music, we have 4,500 popular music students studying our bachelors of music, and nearly all of them are songwriters. So they are hyper aware, because obviously they're a very web literate generation. They're hyper aware of all this talk in the media and online about song similarity. So one of the things that has perhaps increased awareness is just the ubiquity of streaming and the ease of access, that anyone can create a YouTube mashup without purchasing a CD or whatever back in the day. But there is another musical phenomenon that perhaps contributes to this, and maybe the Katy Perry case highlights it, which is that musical gestures have arguably gotten shorter. That is, in the first half of the 20th century, the dominant song form was the 32-bar standard, which is 2 8-bar verses, an 8-bar bridge, and then an 8-bar concluding verse. So the musical unit was grouped into 2, 4, and often 8 bars. With sort of R&B and hip-hop influenced genres, we often have very short gestures, you know, a short riff that's repeated, a 4-chord loop, and so on. And because those gestures musically are shorter, obviously the statistical likelihood of coincidental similarity has the statistical likelihood of coincidental similarity can increase.
Joe Bennett is a forensic musicologist from Berklee College of Music in Boston. Joe, thank you so much. This was highly informative and just a lot of fun. Thanks for joining us.
Great speaking to you, Tanzina.
That's our show for today. Thanks so much for listening. I'm Tanzina Vega, and this is The Takeaway. Dulang, dulang, handsome boy.